The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First up, news about a controversial treatment for depression.
Right, Carrie. This kind of might sound like science fiction, but since the 1930s, doctors have actually been jolting people with electricity. They actually have been hooking up electrodes to people's heads and zapping them to cure depression. The amazing thing is it actually works, but it has a lot of side effects. It can cause memory loss and confusion, and it can even lead to difficulty forming new memories. So this new study is all about trying to figure out, why does this shocking people's brains, why does it actually even help depression in the first place? And if we learn more about it, can it lead to better ways to apply this therapy without some of the nasty side effects?
And because it has these side effects, it's not used very often, right?
Right now, today, it's really only used for really severely ill patients, including those at risk for suicide, mm-hmm. where you wouldn't care as much about the side effects because the disease is a lot more serious than the side effects. What researchers did in this study was they actually looked at a bunch of patients and they scanned them with fMRI, which is a technique which measures blood flow in their brain. And one of the going hypotheses about what causes depression is the idea that the brain is actually overactive, that all these regions of the brain are communicating way too much with themselves. So the brain actually becomes preoccupied essentially with itself. It closes itself closes itself off to information from the outside world, which seems to lead to depression. And what the researchers found is that actually seems to be what's happening in these patients' brains. What the researchers did was they looked at the entire brain of these volunteers and they looked for changes in blood oxygenization in about 27,000 points known as voxels. And these voxels are essentially the 3D imaging equivalent of pixels on a computer screen. Voxels were considered highly connected if their changes in blood oxygenization were strongly correlated. That is, if one went up and the other went up to a similar degree. And indeed, that's what the researchers found. They found that there was a lot of connectivity between these voxels in depressed patients, which seems to support this hypothesis that people with depression tend to have a lot of this sort of crosstalk going on inside of their brains.
So what are the implications of this on electroconvulsive therapy?
Well, what the researchers also saw with electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT as they call it, is that when they shocked these patients' brain, they saw decreases in this connectivity between these voxels, and they saw less of this sort of hyperactive crosstalk going on in the brain. So their conclusion is that this is how ECT is working. It's stopping the brain from sort of talking to itself so much. And the open question really remains is, you know, using these data, can they find a way to administer ECT without causing such harmful side effects? And that's a point for future study.
So scientists have been using this method for 80 years without actually knowing the parts of brain that it targets?
Right. They just sort of know that it works, but they really didn't know how it worked. And now they've got a pretty good idea.
Wow. And moving on to our next story, we've got some marine acrobatics.
Right. This story, Carrie, is about two species of minuscule crustaceans called copepods, which seem to perform some pretty bizarre acrobatics at the surface of the ocean. They leap out of the water and somersault, sometimes at rates of 7,500 revolutions per minute to escape predators. It's sort of like a bit of a flea circus on the top of the ocean. This new discovery is actually thanks to a researcher who sort of made it by accident. He works at the University of Texas in Austin, and his daily routine is actually to walk along the university's marina, which sits on the Gulf of Mexico. And one day he's walking along and he noticed this unusual pattern in the water. He says it looked like there were raindrops hitting the surface. So sort of interested in what was going on, he ran back to his lab, grabbed a beaker and scooped up some of the marina water.
Fast thinker.
Exactly. And when he got back to the lab, he discovered these copepods that were living in the water. And you can see a picture of them on the site. They kind of look like tiny lobsters, although they're the size of, actually they're smaller than most ants, so they're really small, but kind of interesting looking. And when he threw some plankton eating fish into the water with these guys, he saw them jumping to safety. Then he grabbed some high speed video cameras and actually taped what was going on. And what he saw was that these copepods, when they were threatened by a predator, they were essentially flying out of the water. They're hitting speeds of about 0.66 meters per second and landing up to 17 centimeters away. And you can actually see a video. It's a bit of a grainy video, but you can see a video of this actually happening on the site.
So this is actually a pretty effective technique for escaping predators.
Exactly. The researchers saw that when the organisms conducted themselves this way, only about one of the 89 jumping crustaceans that this researcher and some of his colleagues saw wound up getting eaten on camera. So it's a very dramatic strategy and also a very effective one as well.
So you said that they can spring themselves really, really quickly. They can go far. They spin a ridiculous number of times per minute. How can such tiny creatures launch themselves with so much force?
What the researchers saw with their high-speed videos is that these creatures are actually launching themselves with just a single swimming stroke, which is actually kind of amazing. And part of the trick of how they're able to go so far is they actually expend an enormous amount of energy, about 88% of the initial energy required just escaping from the water. Think of yourself in a swimming pool and how hard it is to move around. But then if you get out, all of a sudden it seems a lot easier. That's essentially what's happening with these guys. All this energy that they expend getting to the surface of the water, it sort of explodes when they get out of the water and they're able to just sort of jump and somersault in these sort of incredible ways.
Well, that's pretty incredible.
It is.
And in our third story today, we're talking about some of the earliest brown-eyed girls.
Right. This study, Carrie, concerns Neanderthals, which died out about 30,000 or more years ago. And if you've ever gone to a museum that had a Neanderthal exhibit, you probably saw these relatives of ours sporting pretty striking blue or green eyes. They look like they have pale skin and gingery hair. And this is sort of the typical artist's conception. But a new study suggests that not all Neanderthals look this way. In fact, a couple of female Neanderthals found in Croatia seem to have actually been brown-eyed with brunette tresses and tawny skin to match.
So why did scientists initially think that they may have had lighter colored eyes?
Well, Carrie, there's been this long-held hypothesis that Neanderthals, who lived mostly in the northern latitudes where it was pretty cold, must have had light skin to get enough vitamin D. And that could have gone along with eye color and some of these other features that people had sort of assumed. And that may have sort of lent itself to some of these artist conceptions you see in various museums around the world.
So what new information makes scientists think that, in fact, brown was the common eye color?
Well, what the researchers did in this study was they actually looked at a lot of DNA from three female Neanderthals that were found in Croatia. And their DNA was actually the basis of the first effort to compile a complete Neanderthal genetic sequence, which was published just a couple of years ago. And what the team found was they found multiple genes, which we know in humans seem to control various visual traits like eye color and skin color and things like that. And it turns out there's not just one gene for, say, green eyes and one gene for brown hair. There's actually a lot of genes that, when you add them all up, confer various colors. And what they found, for example, was one of the females had seven genes for brown eyes, one for not brown eyes, three for blue eyes, and four for not blue eyes. And what the researchers say is when you sort of add all these up, this gives a six-gene balance in favor of brown and a negative balance in favor of blue, which to them indicates that this particular individual's eyes were probably browned. And what they found was that when they applied this methodology to all three Neanderthals, all three seemed to have had a dark complexion and brown eyes, although one was red-haired.
So do scientists think that their previous impressions were wrong or that just that there might be more diversity than we expected from Neanderthals?
Well, experts are saying we shouldn't necessarily give all those museum mannequins a makeover just yet. They're saying that this additive technique really has a lot of problems because you can't just assume that every gene you look at has the same effect on hair color, eye color, whatever. Some genes are known in humans to have much more powerful effects than others. So just sort of simply adding and subtracting, they say, doesn't really give a convincing picture of what these look like. Although the experts are conceding that, you know, it's probably true that all Neanderthals didn't look exactly the same. And the important thing about this study is it does suggest that there was probably a lot of diversity in these populations, just as there is in our own population.
Right. And so what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how scientists are measuring the energy spent while people do judo, which is one of the martial arts. Also a story about whether there are dangerous levels of mercury in coastal fog water. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how biotech patents are faring in the Supreme Court of the United States. Also a story about the National Children's Study, which is this huge effort that's been proposed by the National Institutes of Health to track 100,000 U.S. children from birth to 21 years old. And what's status of that study. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about whether animals are capable of human thoughts. And next week's Science Live is about personalized medicine. Will our new era of personalized genomics lead to better treatments in the clinic? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.